The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Derek Frost from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. Today's program is generously underwritten by Brian Lee Funeral Homes located in Raleigh, Garner, and Anger. They can be reached at 919-832-8225. They believe every life is unique and deserves to be honored so that every funeral is as unique and special as the person it represents. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the special feature headline, 2019 Year in Review. And we'll be reading articles from all the different beats. The first one, Wake Stone Gets Lease, RDU Allows Quarry Expansion Despite an Uproar About the Deal, written by Lauren Onisorge. The controversy came to a head March 1 when, after just 15 minutes, the Raleigh-Durham Airport Authority voted to approve the lease of a swath of airport-owned land near Umpstead State Park to Wake Stone Corporation for a quarry expansion. As the crowd looked on, peppered with protesters holding Stop RDU Quarry signs, it was announced that there would be no public comment on the decision. The fight is not over, trail advocate Natalie Liu told the crowd at the time. And she was right. Soon the Umpstead Coalition, Triangle Off-Road Cyclists, and others would file a lawsuit against RDU, claiming it didn't have the authority to unilaterally lease the land without the express permission of its backing municipalities, Raleigh, Durham, and Wake and Durham counties. Those municipalities, over the weeks that followed, refused to get involved in the suit, which ultimately went in RDU's favor, though activists have filed their appeal. In the meantime, Wake Stone initiated exploratory drilling and has begun planning for permit filings, the next step in its plans to expand the aging quarry it has on an adjacent site. And it's optimistic it can work with the community to come up with a compromise. It has even agreed to put up $3.6 million to support a mountain bike park, though no party has come forward to lease the land for that purpose, RDU has said. For RDU, every bit of cash is critical as it works on an ambitious airport revamp, and that means the $24 million the airport is expected to glean from the lease could be vital. But the opposition, now speaking out against an RDU fencing plan near that quarry, says its own plan to reel in outdoor recreation businesses at an urban trail center could mean even more money. And despite the outcome of the suit, opponents continue to circulate that message through petitions, social media, and emails to public officials. RDU officials have called messages it's circulating about its fencing plan scare tactics meant to further their anti-quarry agenda. RDU officials insist their fence plan will not cut off trail access at Umpstead State Park. Caleb Harshberger is the writer of our next story. The headline, Raleigh's Warehouse District Continues to Explode. Coming off a year of major development and transit upgrades, developers and property owners in Raleigh's Warehouse District enter 2019 with big plans to continue the transformation from a squat industrial district into one of the major downtown hubs in the region. This year alone saw numerous plans, projects, and rezonings proposed. Just 2 months ago, the Raleigh City Council approved rezoning the site of Go Triangle's RUS bus projects across from Union Station to allow for up to 40 stories of development set to begin next year. The project is part of the city's multimodal transit project that will see the new bus station work in tandem with Union Station to ferry visitors and commuters to Raleigh by train and then by bus from there. Go Triangle has begun negotiations with its preferred development partner. Nearby, and just 2 months into the new year, three property owners, including Cam Raleigh and Centerline Properties, filed a rezoning request with the city to allow the development of a proposed mixed-use project. In July, the third owner of the group, attorney Gary Field, said that if approved, the project would feature around 500,000 square feet of mixed-use space, including around 40,000 square feet of retail, 230,000 square feet of Class A office space, and 170,000 square feet of residential units. He estimated it would cost roughly $200 million to build. That request is still making its way through the approval process. Last month, it went back to the Planning Commission, where the property owners are considering asking for the property to be rezoned to allow for up to 40 stories of development after council members suggested affordable housing conditions be added to the request. The district also saw the opening of downtown Raleigh's first and currently only grocery store after Weaver Street Market opened this fall at the Dillon, which opened the year before. Meanwhile, the development has spilled over to the other side of the tracks, where several projects announced on West Cabrera Street, including a six-story, three-building development at the site of the company's longtime headquarters on West Cabrera Street, and a retail and dining destination dubbed the West Cabrera's Warehouse. And along with that article, there are some a section called By the Numbers. Here's a look at what's planned for Raleigh's booming warehouse district. 10, the number of new restaurants. 11, the number of stores and retail shops. 6, the number of art galleries. 81,000, the number of square feet of retail space under construction. Path to prosperity, rough on startups. That's our next article, written by Seth Thomas Gulledge. Though the Triangle's life sciences industry is undeniably booming, many of its public startups endured tough times in 2019. It's a fact that underscores the high risk and high reward nature of one of the region's most important sectors. Some companies, such as Syneos, skyrocket to prominence, while others scrounge for dollars. Perhaps no company in the region had a more difficult year than Research Triangle Park-based Transenterix. Starting the year with its stock trading as high as $42 per share, the company has seen a steady, sharp decline in the months since. As of mid-December, the company was trading as low as $1.90, saved only by a reverse stock split that brought per-share value up from the abysmal 13 cents it was selling at prior. Lagging sales of its surgical robot has brought the company to the precipice. In its last earnings report, the company said it had only enough money to make it into first quarter 2020. Complicating that delicate position is an array of executive turnover, with both its CEO, Todd Pope, and chief financial officer leaving. New leader, Anthony Fernando, says he's confident the company has a future, even as it's hired a firm to explore options. Besides Transenterix, both Morrisville-based Liquidia and Durham-based BioCryst have also seen over 100% drops in their stock values while they fight their own pre-approval battles. BioCryst has managed to bring in more than $100 million in the last months of the year to fund commercial efforts next year, a make-it-or-break-it moment in the company's history. Other Triangle companies have gone the way of M&A. Raleigh-based Innovative Biopharmaceuticals has announced a merger with Israeli-based RDD Pharma, where it will take on a new name led by RDD leadership, and Durham's Dova Pharmaceuticals was acquired for $868 million. Even companies that have seen positive changes in value this year come on the backs of less than advantageous circumstances. Durham's Novan started the year short of funding and leadership and came close to delisting on public markets over the summer. The company has since climbed, more than doubling its stock value since January. Dason Kavik's main story has the headline, Distilleries Boom in Triangle. The rise of bourbon and distilleries is a surging trend here in the Triangle and beyond in 2019. The state is home to 59 distilleries, with 16 in the Triangle. Operations such as Durham Distillery and Greybeard Distillery, known for its Bedlam Vodka, have won awards this past year. Lee and Melissa Katrinchik of Durham Distillery struck up a new partnership with New York-based Constellation Brands to help distribute their gin across the East Coast. When we started in 2013, we said that North Carolina will always be first and foremost, says Melissa Katrinchik. When it comes to getting distribution in different states and really forming the right distribution, you just need to understand where you are in their portfolio totem pole, she says. The distillery has increased its production by 85% year over year from 2018 to 2019. In Raleigh, Lone Rider Spirits gained traction in the market this past year after its product arrived in late 2018. Its cherry cask bourbon whiskey saw local beer drinkers take to the bourbon to see what the brewery could do in its new genre. Lone Rider Spirits also released its first canned cocktail, the Whiskey Mule, a play off the popular vodka drink, Moscow Mule. And in 2019, North Carolina saw the ABC Regulatory Reform Act pass with a 31-10 vote in the North Carolina Senate, which now allows distilleries to sell mixed drinks on their premises. This has allowed local businesses such as Lassiter Distilling Company in Knightdale, as well as Instill Distilling in Clayton, to serve drinks using their beverages after guided tours of the distilling process. In 2019, Social House Vodka, which currently produces its vodka in Kinston, brought in a new chief financial officer, Jeff Eakes, and is currently looking for a location in downtown Raleigh to make and serve its vodka. It's important for people to experience our product, Social House President Carrie Joshi says. We are looking to create some additional products and want people to understand the brand. Our next article, written by Dane Huffman, is headlined, Getting a Facelift, PNC Arena Will Add Amenities to Become More Fan-Friendly. Some major wins for PNC Arena off the ice in 2019 set in motion major changes, changes that will impact the future of professional sports in the arena. First, the Centennial Authority, the governing body of the arena, paid off the initial loan that dated back to when the arena opened in 1999. Then the authority won significant future dollars when city and county leaders awarded its $9 million per year over 25 years beginning in July. The Centennial Authority was in a battle for the dollars with multiple other projects, most specifically the Downtown South Sports and Entertainment Complex, and it was a major validation for an arena that is only now beginning to see development around it. But the changes to the building won't happen overnight. PNC leaders will spend the first months of 2020 looking at possibilities and then setting timelines that will limit the disruptions for basketball and hockey seasons. The new rooftop bar, for example, is unlikely to be ready next season. But the coming changes are significant in that the arena's lease with the Carolina Hurricanes only runs through 2024. The Centennial Authority has hired Dan Barrett, executive vice president of the national firm CAA Icon and an expert in sports valuations, to help it in the negotiations. We have to maintain the building regardless of whether the hockey team is here, says Tom McCormick, chair of the Centennial Authority. This region needs a facility like this, he says. And before reading more 2019 year in review stories, we'll turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle happenings written by managing editor Dane Huffman. The first headline, interest in downtown Raleigh reflected in condo sales. A condominium development with a bold, modern look is rising in Raleigh, and its brisk sales are reflecting the surging level of interest in living downtown. Frank Thompson, who is partnering with Lee Norris on The Fairweather, says the development already has sold 34 of 45 units. The project could be completed by the summer. We expect to be sold out pretty quickly, he says. The project includes 1, 2, and 3-bedroom units. There's a big market for downtown and limited inventory of stuff. We have an innovative product and push the design, Thompson says. It's a nice high-end product. The project is located at 525 Southwest Street, a corner of downtown that was, not long ago, largely overlooked. But development is quickly changing the area, which serves the primary corridor from downtown to Dix Park. The developers paid $1.8 million for the lots. Condos start at $425,000. A 3-bedroom penthouse has 1,932 square feet and is being sold for $1.015 million. Change coming at beloved Raleigh restaurant. One of Raleigh's most loved restaurants could soon undergo an ownership change. Arthur Gordon, who founded Irregardless Cafe in 1975, isn't making any announcements just yet. Nothing's official, Gordon says. And local entrepreneur David Meeker, the owner of Trophy Brewing Company, is not confirming he will be taking over the restaurant. But Triangle Business Journal has learned Gordon is planning a special event New Year's Eve to celebrate the restaurant, thank people for their support, and announced the sale. Gordon established the restaurant when Raleigh featured few outstanding places to eat. Irregardless Cafe quickly attracted a crowd drawn by its vegetarian options and offerings built around fresh produce. Irregardless Cafe also features music and a variety of food options. While the food scene in Raleigh has exploded, the Irregardless, located at 901 West Morgan Street, has been a leader for decades in the Triangle food scene. Colorful Bible lands at Duke Divinity School. On the heels of Duke University's Divinity School receiving a $12 million gift, it has now received another priceless gift this holiday season, a handwritten, hand-painted version of the Bible. The St. John's Bible was commissioned in the late 1990s by St. John's University in Minnesota to bring the Bible with contemporary flourishes and interpretation to a modern audience. It was created by a team of scribes and artists who wrote the Bible's text by hand while illuminating it with colorful visuals over a decade. The school says it intends to use it for educational purposes, but any member of the public can also go to the Divinity School Library adjacent to Duke Chapel most Wednesdays during the spring semester from noon to 1 p.m. for a guided tour. Headliner at economic event is new CEO of Truist. Now that BB&T and SunTrust have combined to create Truist Financial Corporation, the schedule of its new leader is filling up. Former BB&T head Kelly King, tapped to lead Truist as chairman and CEO, was just named the keynote speaker for the 18th Annual Economic Forecast Forum. The event is put on by the North Carolina Bankers Association and the North Carolina Chamber of Commerce and happens January 7 at the Sheridan Imperial in Durham. Co-working spaces move into Apex. New co-working spaces have opened in Apex as the town works to attract increased commercial investment and development and develop a healthy environment for small businesses and local entrepreneurs. Coming off the success of its Holly Springs location, Co-working Station has opened two locations in Apex, with one in the Olive Chapel Professional Park and the other downtown. "We've been waiting a long time to get these open, and it's finally happened," says Joanna Helms, Economic Development Director for the town of Apex. Apex provided the research into whether the location would be a good fit for the company, as well as financial assistance. "We developed the initial research, put some financial resources behind the upfit cost for the facility, assisting with the fiber connection and a percentage of the lease rate for the first couple of years," she says. Co-working Station's community manager, Ashley Thompson, says the partnership with the town was instrumental in bringing Co-working Station to Apex. "Our Holly Springs location has been full for 2 of the 3 years," Thompson says, noting that with the success of the location, it made sense to expand. Now that's quite a sweet ride for the Pink CEO. Cindy Eckerd is taking Pink to a new level. The local entrepreneur who led the creation of the female Viagra and founded the Pink Ceiling was spotted in a sweet Lamborghini, and yes, it was pink. But Eckerd was quick to point out she did not buy the car. She was only racing it. Okay, then. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the Viewpoint page, where we read the editor's notebook written by Sugata Mukherjee, editor of the Triangle Business Journal. The headline, "Let's Stop Talking About Apple Coming to Wake County." Almost a year ago to the day, Apple announced it was expanding operations in Austin, Texas, and not North Carolina. Last month, the company broke ground on its new $1 billion, 3 million square foot campus that will initially employ 5,000 workers and grow to 15,000 by 2022. Yes, we lost that project. On December 28 last year, we broke a story about a California buyer picking up 281 acres inside Research Triangle Park. We connected the identified registered agent of the buyer with Apple. And before we knew it, everyone picked up on that lawyer corporation and started speculating that Apple was not yet done with North Carolina. Of course, we joined the drumbeat as well. After all, it was our story. But here's the truth. I believe Apple currently has zero plans for North Carolina. They may own the land through a third-party deal, but it's highly unlikely they will announce another $1 billion-plus facility with 15,000 jobs for Wake County. There was a reason why they forced the Research Triangle Foundation, the RTP landlord, to change some of the covenants regarding the development timeline to give the company more time. What is surprising is that North Carolina Economic Developers, headed by Commerce Secretary Tony Copeland, are playing the game of non-disclosure agreement with North Carolinians to decline to release details of the Apple project we lost last year. They claim Apple is still an active project, and the reason it is an active project is because of the land the company bought in RTP last year, they would claim. Here's the problem with that argument. If Apple ever wanted to build anything in RTP, it is a different project altogether. So North Carolina's incentive plans for the lost project should be made public. Otherwise, what Copeland and Governor Roy Cooper preach to us every week about transparency rings hollow. Apple is a publicly traded company, and when the company decides on billions of dollars of additional capital investments regarding plants, machinery, and equipment, that becomes a material item and has to be disclosed to shareholders during an earnings call. Again, the company does have the right to keep trade secrets and economic development details confidential until they're finalized. But really, what are the chances the board will approve another cost-heavy project without assessing the company's latest expansion in Austin? I think North Carolina officials are using the RTP land as a crutch to hold off releasing information on what exactly happened to the project. Maybe the weakness of our developers will show up in emails, or maybe the real reasons, which many believe is the North Carolina General Assembly's heavy hand on crafting social policies, will come to light before elections. As far as economic development, Apple and Amazon not picking Wake County has not hurt the area's job recruitment prowess. In fiscal 2018 to 2019, new and existing businesses announced 8,273 jobs for Wake County and $519 million in investment. The jobs number was even higher in 2017 to 2018, 9,219. So why this secrecy about one project? By releasing the email trail, the incentives package, and the rejection reasons, maybe we will learn something about ourselves and our communities. And also on the Viewpoint page, an article written by Andrew Silton, who is the former chief investment officer for the North Carolina Office of the Treasurer. The headline, "A Big No-No at the NC Public Pension." North Carolina State Treasurer Dale Falwell is sole fiduciary of the state's various pension plans. As a result, he has investment authority over $100 billion in assets. Unfortunately, Falwell has committed two cardinal and elementary mistakes that should be of deep concern to retirees, public servants, and taxpayers. First, he violated the long-term investment rule against market timing when he sold $8.5 billion in equities over the course of this past summer and fall. The proceeds are sitting in cash where they do not earn a meaningful return. Second, he violated the rule against making the same investment mistake twice. Back in 2017, Falwell decided to time the market by selling $7.4 billion in equities and put the proceeds in cash and bonds. This first attempt at market timing failed because equity prices have risen by more than one-third. To break even on this speculation, the Dow Jones Industrial Average would have to fall by about 10,000 points. In both cases, the state treasurer has violated his own investment guidelines, and the pension system has paid the price. His first attempt to time the stock market in 2017 has cost the pension plan about $2.2 billion in value. And his decision in 2019 to move long-term investments into cash has cost the pension another $400 million. I don't doubt the state treasurer's worries about the current state of the equity markets. By most measures, stock prices are relatively expensive and the earnings outlook is clouded by global tensions and U.S. trade policy. So there's plenty to worry about in today's market environment. Just as there was a lot to fret about 2 years ago when Falwell first departed from the pension's strategic asset allocation and moved $7.4 billion out of stocks. Even if the state treasurer were to get lucky and correctly time a decline in the stock market, he'd still have the near impossible task of figuring out when to put the pile of cash back into equities. Market timing requires two highly speculative decisions: selling stock, and eventually having the courage to reinvest in the throes of a declining market. Pension investing is a long-term exercise. Assets need to grow over 20 and 30-year time horizons to meet the needs of retirees and reduce the burden on taxpayers. Investment fiduciaries must look beyond the near-term twists and turns of the stock market and avoid the temptation to engage in short-term trading because market timing is a fool's errand. The state treasurer almost always highlights the $225 million of savings he has achieved by firing managers and renegotiating fees. Ironically, much of the fee reduction was simply created when the treasurer decided to time the market back in 2017. Cash and bond investments have far lower fees than equities. In any event, the $225 million in fee savings pales in comparison to the $2.6 billion in lost value to the retirees, employees, and taxpayers of North Carolina due to the state treasurer's decision to time the market. It's been 2 years since Kevin Sigrist resigned as chief investment officer, and Falwell has still not named a replacement. While the two interim CIOs are consummate professionals, they have other investment responsibilities and don't enjoy the imprimatur that comes with being the CIO. Although the treasurer has the ultimate say on investment decisions, a good CIO is a necessary sounding board. In fact, Sigrist attempted to give Falwell sound advice against timing the markets back in 2017, and the treasurer may not have taken kindly to the guidance. Our North Carolina state treasurer sits atop a $100 billion pension plan. He doesn't answer to a board of trustees, and he doesn't debate policy or investment decisions with a CIO. But all North Carolinians must pay close attention to policies that shape the fiscal strength of our pension plan. Now we return to our 2019 year in review stories with some stories written by Lauren Onasorge. Raleigh wealth manager gets long prison sentence. Today, Stephen Condon Peters is known by the number 6443905-6, and he's sitting in federal prison in Virginia with a projected release date of July 5, 2053. After years of back-and-forth motions, many resulting in delays, Peters went to trial in June for what the feds have called a Ponzi scheme. With Peters' own testimony, the public heard his side of the story for the first time. While prosecutors said he bilked Vision Quest wealth management clients to the tune of $15 million, Peters insisted they were just bad investments. While prosecutors accused him of forging documents to cover up the scheme, Peters pointed to his own employees. Jurors sided with the prosecutors. Peters is appealing his conviction. The case isn't over for the victims, many of whom are elderly. Prosecutors have said Peters' assets aren't adding up to what was lost and are still undergoing forfeiture proceedings. A court filing in November shows how, if it could be recovered, the $15.2 million Peters is said to have profited would be split between 66 victims. Many are not optimistic. And Peters' legal team still has strategies to pursue. Just last month, the government accused Peters of trying to unravel the forfeiture of the family's farm. Peters' claims was withdrawn. But the greater forfeiture case continues to play itself out through court filings. And here's a section on Stephen Peters' assets the government is seeking. Here's a look at some of what the government is trying to grab. 2014 Cadillac Escalade, multicolor brown and green striped sofa, vintage manual wine corker, Olhausen pool table with cover, balls, and accessories, Arctic Wind Air hockey table with primitive wood-style cabinet finish, 24-foot shuffleboard table, Southwestern motif vase, a club golf car with two flat tires, Polaris Sportsman 400 ATV, Yamaha TTR 230 dirt bike, Zenith antique radio, and a John Deere tractor. Lindbergh bribery allegations hit North Carolina's GOP. A bribery scandal unveiled in April rocked the North Carolina Republican Party as one of its biggest political donors was indicted. Eli Global founder Greg Lindbergh was accused of trading political donations for favors from the North Carolina Department of Insurance. Also indicted was Chapel Hill-based consultant John Gray, Eli Global Vice President John Palermo, and then North Carolina GOP Chairman Robin Hayes. The indictment claimed defendants corruptly gave, offered, and promised things of value, including millions of dollars in campaign contributions, for NCDOI actions favorable to Eli Global's insurance companies, such as the removal of a deputy commissioner. It turned out NCDOI Commissioner Mike Causey was cooperating with the Federal Bureau of Investigation, helping it build its case. Since the indictment, his team has worked with the legislature to revamp the policies that created the loopholes the government claims Eli Global had exploited for years. But Causey's connection to Eli Global, now called Global Growth, isn't just this case, as its insurance assets are undergoing what's known as rehabilitation. And that means they're now under Causey's department's purview. As it tried to right the insurance companies, NCDOI halted commission checks for some of the companies in the portfolio, causing issues for longtime sales executives. In the meantime, the case against Lindbergh continues. Lindbergh, through his attorneys, has professed his innocence. In September, Lindbergh asked the judge to toss the indictment entirely for failure to state an offense. Light rail suffers deadly blow in Triangle. Despite millions of dollars and years of effort, the Durham-Orange Light Rail Transit Project, once thought by some to be among the most vital transportation projects in the state, fizzled completely this year. The challenges had been stacking up for some time, particularly in North Carolina's legislature. And 2019 brought the project's biggest hurdles. A federal government shutdown had delayed vital regulatory oversight. The Federal Transit Administration then required Go Triangle to add an additional $237 million to its cost projections. And the North Carolina Railroad Company, despite back-and-forth negotiations, had yet to signal its complete support. In February came what was thought by some to be the death blow, when Duke University officials made it clear they would not be signing the cooperative agreement Go Triangle needed to secure federal funds for the project. For more than a decade, and more intensely over the past year, Go Triangle and local elected officials have worked closely with the university to address concerns, so Duke's action today is especially disappointing, Go Triangle said at the time. On March 27, Go Triangle's board voted and, with the disappointed approval of its general manager, Jeff Mann, decided to recommend suspending the project entirely. After years of planning and, at the time, more than $130 million already spent in local tax dollars, the proposed $2.5 billion, 17.7-mile project had been nearing deadlines for federal funding. Without the support of Duke and the railroad, it was clear it wouldn't be able to meet those deadlines. Mann resigned June 26 for other opportunities. While officials have confirmed they're interviewing candidates, his successor has yet to be named. That's as officials have been touting opportunities with what they're hoping is the next transportation game changer, bus rapid transit, dedicated bus lines and faster service meant to cut down on the congestion that continues to build alongside the Triangle's economic successes. And now we have a group of stories written by Caleb Harshberger. Triangle grocery wars heat up. Wegmans enters the market as competition rises. As crowds of new people continue to flock to the Triangle every day, grocers around the world have been taking notice. In 2019, the Triangle saw major grocery and supermarket companies spend heavily to expand their local footprints from affordable chains such as Aldi and Lidl to more traditional supermarkets such as Publix. The region also saw the opening of the first Wegmans grocery store, the first of six planned for the region. That location opened September 29 at 1200 Waketown Drive in Raleigh and was greeted by tens of thousands of new customers. It was the company's 100th store opening. And Wegmans president and CEO Colleen Wegman says the six stores represent an abnormally large investment in a single market. "We're placing a big bet here," she says. "We're excited about the market and hope they like us here. It's a big deal for us." Other locations include Wake Forest, Holly Springs, Chapel Hill, and Two in Cary. 2019 also saw downtown Raleigh get its first grocery store with the opening of the Weaver Street Market in the Warehouse District. That location opened in September and represents what Weaver Street Market General Manager Ruffin Slater says will be the first of several stores that he hopes to bring to Wake County. Meanwhile, a second downtown grocer is planned for a location at the ongoing Kane Realty Company and Williams Realty Company's Smoky Hollow. Durham takes multi-pronged approach to address affordable housing. As rapid growth and development continues to sweep across the region, officials and developers in Durham spent much of the last year working on ways to ensure housing for low-income residents. From housing bonds and regional partnerships to the redevelopment plans of the Durham Police Department headquarters, the city has taken steps to address the need for affordable housing in the city. These efforts reached a crescendo last month when the city voted overwhelmingly to pass a $95 million affordable housing bond advertised to help as many as 15,000 city residents with housing. Additionally, the redevelopment of the former Durham Police Headquarters is expected to bring hundreds of units with 90 designated for affordable housing. In October, the Durham Housing Authority and the Durham Habitat for Humanity announced a partnership to build affordable single-family homes. As the area continues to see growing interest from developers, there's much that officials say can be done to address the issue of affordability. At a Triangle Business Journal event earlier this year, Scott Harmon, a Durham architect and developer at Center Studio Architecture, made the case for more affordable housing, saying cities should work to increase the total number of residential units, increase density, and allow for smaller, affordable residential units. "We need more housing," he said. "We just need more of it, and we need to increase density." He urged Triangle municipalities to review their land use policies to encourage growth and efficiency in development. And along with this section, over this article, there's a section called By the Numbers. Funds will go to build 1,600 new affordable housing units and preserve 800 affordable rental units. Move 1,700 homeless individuals and households into permanent housing. Provide 400 affordable home ownership opportunities for first-time home buyers, and help 3,000 low-income renters and homeowners remain in or improve their homes. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, some stories written by Seth Thomas Gulledge. Arrest of CEO casts shadow over Blue Cross NC's plans. What started as a year of promise for the state's largest health insurer will instead close as one tainted with controversy, lost opportunities, and lasting questions about its momentum to drive promised change. Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina, BCBSNC, made national news early in the year when it unveiled value-based care contracts with five of the state's largest healthcare systems. The Blue Premier contracts were a momentous step away from the traditional fee-for-service model, long accused as a culprit for higher prices and lower quality in American healthcare, and toward a more holistic, patient-first model. The company declared it would steadily move all of its customers onto similar contracts in the years ahead. But then, news leaked that the CEO driving that change, Dr. Patrick Conway, had been charged with a DWI in June. Even state government officials condemned the insurer for hiding the arrest and called for Conway to step down, which he eventually did. The misstep caused the company's $16 billion deal with Portland, Oregon-based Cambia to fall through, with no indication whether either company plans to pick it up. Officially, company executives expressed confidence in the insurer's course ahead, saying its goals are institutionally driven, not about single individuals. BCBSNC has since announced two more major health systems joining its Blue Premier plans. UNC system endures year of turmoil. Chaos, infighting, and public outrage marked the year for the University of North Carolina system as multiple leaders across the state stepped down or were fired. President Margaret Spellings abruptly left in January, ending a tenure that lasted less than 3 years. Leaving not long after her was UNC Chapel Hill Chancellor Carol Folt. Folt bucked the UNC Board of Governors by having the Confederate statue known as Silent Sam removed and saying she'd leave in May. The Board of Governors responded by telling her to leave at the end of January. All the drama led to a coalition of North Carolina's top business and educational leaders that spoke out against the UNC system's Board of Governors, claiming its heavy-handed approach is harming the system and state and sabotaging its ability to attract talent. The chaos wasn't just in Chapel Hill. East Carolina University Chancellor Cecil Staton announced in March he was asked to resign. The interim chancellor selected to replace him, Dan Gerlach, became embroiled in a scandal after pictures of him drinking with students at a Greenville bar surfaced online. The ensuing response across the system not only led to Gerlach's resignation, but to allegations that members of the Board of Governors acted improperly by hiring outside counsel to investigate him. Meanwhile, the system became involved in a bitter dispute with Greenville-based Vidant Medical Center, which sought to eject the board's influence over its own governance, and a dispute with ECU trustees over nominations for its board. To cap the year, the system unveiled a settlement handing over stewardship of Silent Sam with a $2.5 million trust dedicated to its preservation to the Sons of Confederate Veterans. Public outcry over that decision reached its peak at the UNC System Board of Governors' last meeting of the year, in which zero board members attended except by telephone, and elected a new chancellor for UNC Chapel Hill, Kevin Guskowitz. Guskowitz made a mark for himself by studying the impact of football on the brain, and in moving to be the permanent chancellor, he stepped into an arena now known for high impact collisions. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to 2019 Stories in Review, written by Dathan Kazuk. New restaurants add flavor to Triangle food scene. A bountiful assortment of restaurants arrived in the Triangle in 2019. From pizza to seafood and new mashups and fusion-style eateries, the past year showcased a variety of cuisine. The Chattanooga, Tennessee-based Stir, with its oyster bar and specialty cocktails, opened at North Hills in June. Later in the year, Chef Georgios Bakatsias opened Rosewater Kitchen and Bar right next door to Stir. This is Bakatsias' first restaurant in Raleigh. For seafood fans, Raleigh saw the Cape Fear Seafood Company come to North Raleigh, and the local oyster bar landed in the new Transfer Food Hall in downtown Raleigh. The food hall also brought in popular vendors such as Benchwarmers Bagels, Dank Burrito, and the juicy burgers you'll find at Mama Crow's. Local area mainstays also contributed to new eateries in 2019. Scott Crawford opened his second restaurant, Jolie, next to the award-winning Crawford & Son. And James Beard winner Ashley Christensen opened up Pools Side Pies right beside Pools. Celebrity chef Kasuchi Tanabe brought his flair for Southern cuisine to downtown Raleigh with High Horse, which filled the hole left by Zydeco downtown. There, Tanabe blends Japanese, Mexican, and American styles into many shareable plates as well as specialty cocktails. Out of the ashes of Buku's downtown location, which was gobbled up by Red Hat, you'll find its new incarnation in Cary as Ko'an. There, executive chef Drew Smith and owner Sean Degnan have brought together Asian cuisine in both small and large plate formats. Over in Durham, more restaurants sprung up in 2019, including Dame's Chicken and Waffles, Northern Spy, Spanglish, and the specialty cocktail bar Kingfisher. Wake Forest saw the opening of Bodega's Tapas, which recently changed hands to new owners, but expect the same great Spanish-style tapas as well as a new French cuisine coming soon. Expansion is the word for 2019 breweries. After almost 7 years of serving beer and pizza, Trophy Brewing Company finally expanded into its new space in November, a move that means more sour beers and more seating for Detroit-style pizzas. Several other breweries have expansion plans. In Raleigh, Crank Arm Brewing Company is planning a production-only expansion off Saunders Street. Gizmo Beer Works expanded its production by leasing out a building across the driveway to its tap room in Raleigh. And Raleigh Brewing Company may be ready to expand in 2020 as well. In Cary, Bond Brothers Beer Company unveiled plans for expansion in August. Coined Eastside, the new expansion will be located inside Eastside Park off Chatham Street and will feature a new tap room and a production facility. Also in Cary, Cotton House Craft Brewers are planning an expansion that will open a new tap room and allow for more beer production and possibly canning for its beers. Meanwhile, one of the oldest breweries in the Triangle, Lone Rider Brewing, took to Wake Forest in early 2019, opening the Hideout Wake Forest. There, the brewery offers up 12 taps as well as mixed drinks using its Lone Rider spirits. And now we have more 2019 update stories by Dane Huffman. ACC games switched to ACC Network. After years of being broadcast on local stations, the Atlantic Coast Conference made a dramatic shift in 2019. The ACC Network debuted in August. The launch of the ESPN-affiliated network had many cable providers and fans scrambling to get the network to stay abreast of the league. Before that, the league had a close relationship with local broadcasters in the Triangle. For example, WRAL was long the home of ACC contests. But in 2016, the ACC announced a 20-year extension of its ESPN deal that would include an ACC channel. The reason essentially is money. According to reports, the Big Ten schools each received $54 million from media contracts and shared revenue, compared to $43 million for the Southeastern Conference and $29.5 million for the ACC. Beer sales begin at college games. Beer, as anyone who saw the movie Animal House knows, has been a staple of college life for decades. But until 2019, beer and wine were not sold at sporting events for public universities. That changed in June after the North Carolina General Assembly passed and Governor Roy Cooper signed House Bill 389, allowing the sale of beer and wine at college events. Beer had been available at professional events such as Carolina Hurricanes and Carolina Panthers games, but the taps were closed for the college games. Both NC State University and UNC Chapel Hill added sales of alcohol. NC State also began a partnership with a new Belgium brewery to produce Old Tuffy beer, a lager with the Wolfpack logo. Soccer complex studied as region weighs funding. The rage in sports now is complexes that mix games and entertainment, such as where the Atlanta Braves now play, and a bold bid to deliver a similar concept to Raleigh remains alive. Steve Malik, owner of the North Carolina Football Club, and John Kane, CEO of Kane Realty, have teamed up on Downtown South. But the bid faces two significant hurdles. First, it failed to get funding from the interlocal agreement, although it still has a shot at a smaller pool of dollars. And Charlotte burst ahead of the Triangle in the race for a Major League Soccer expansion team. A report issued in August by the Urban Land Institute laid out a plan that would include $1.25 billion in developer debt and $371 million in developer equity, plus a broad mix of other public funding. The city and county are looking at options as Malik and Kane now face a Raleigh City Council more open to development. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we'll turn to some general news. Microsoft picks Morrisville over Houston, written by Lauren Onasorge. Details of Microsoft's decision to put 500 jobs in Morrisville and not Houston show what a huge win the decision was for North Carolina. A project briefing released by the North Carolina Department of Commerce called the project highly competitive between the two locations. The project is to support headcount growth for new operations in the company's engineering departments. The capital, estimated to be an investment of $47.5 million, would improve an existing facility and create a state-of-the-art work environment to allow for easier recruitment of a mix of new talent from the finalist community. The company told the state the talent would mostly be software engineering and development skill sets. The jobs have minimum average wages of $125,354 compared to the Wake County average of $58,138. Microsoft has 1,403 employees in Mecklenburg County, and in October, the company committed to creating 430 new jobs in that region. Microsoft now has 547 jobs in Wake County, where it acquired Blue Stripe Software in 2015. Texas documents show offered about $1.3 million in incentives. North Carolina offered nearly $13 million, including a job development investment grant of more than $12.1 million and community college training. Wake County and Morrisville offered up a combined $1.9 million, state records show. Microsoft has evaluated these markets for demographics, labor depth, labor costs, quality of life, cost of living, air accessibility, real estate costs, business environment, taxes, climate, and natural disaster risk, and the availability of economic incentives, the briefing reads. The principal differences at this point are related to upfront and ongoing operational costs, equipment, investment, labor, utilities, taxes, etc., and the availability of potential state and local incentives to assist with offsetting some of those costs, the briefing notes. This is a major win, says John Boyd, a site selection expert from New Jersey. This is Microsoft's second big expansion in recent years. It's a great endorsement of North Carolina's business climate, he says. And now we turn to the small business section to read Edward Marshall's column. Edward Marshall is an author, executive coach, and adjunct professor in management at the Fuqua School of Business and the Pratt School of Engineering at Duke University. The headline, One Key to Transformation is to Give Workers Control. The sausage line at Johnsonville Sausage ran right by CEO Ralph Stayer's office on the second floor of the plant. Every day at noon, he would come out to taste the sausage while all the workers below stopped to see if it passed Steyr's quality test. It was emblematic of Steyr's command and control leadership style at the time, that he was standing above the workers in the power position, and that it was his decision alone whether the sausage was of sufficient quality that they could keep producing it. He had completely disempowered them. Realizing his company could not grow if he had to make all the decisions, Steyr started a leadership journey intended to transform the culture, the first step of which was to transform himself. Why did he have this need for power and control? Why were his workers missing work and making mistakes? What could he do to change the culture of his company? The result of Steyr's high degree of self-awareness and empathy for his workers was a fundamental transformation of the leadership culture of Johnsonville Sausage. He stopped expecting his people to be incapable. He gave them ownership of their jobs, the company's vision and mission, the making of sausage, and satisfying their customers. He flattened the pyramidal structure, got rid of the human resources department, and created coaching for all workers. He trusted his workforce, gave them responsibility, and let them hold each other accountable. Now, any worker on the sausage line could pull the chain and stop it if they believed the quality of the sausage was not up to standard. Even today, they own this company at every level. In fact, Steyr at once mused, "For the last 5 years, my ambition has been to eliminate my job." Since the 1970s, over 70% of all change processes have failed. Johnsonville Sausage's 10-year journey to a collaborative leadership culture was a phenomenal success for two main reasons. One, leadership was self-aware and willing to change. And two, workforce ownership of the change process. In my 35 years of experience facilitating corporate change initiatives and backed by research, the key to successful organizational change is giving the people who most live with its consequences ownership of the process. Not doing so results in fear, resistance, and even sabotage. Morale declines, people run for cover, and the effective work of the organization can come to a standstill until the dust settles. In my work at companies such as Marriott and DuPont, I found that even when people were going to lose their jobs, they still wanted to be involved in the process because they cared about the company. It's counterintuitive, I know, but I witnessed this degree of ownership on many occasions. Collaborative change processes grounded in a deep respect for the dreams, hopes, pride, and energy of the workforce can fundamentally transform a company's culture and performance. At the end of the day, leaders cannot control change. They just need to give ownership to the workforce to implement it. It's all about the people. And in a section called The List, the fast world of 5G. After years in development, the real buzz about 5G really began to gain traction about a year or so ago, and now it's beginning to slowly roll out. All the major carriers now have plans for getting 5G to the masses, with some starting to roll out fixed 5G to select locales a couple of years ago. But what's the hype all about? Triangle Business Journal dove a bit deeper into the new frontier and how it promises to connect us faster. What is 5G? It's the next or fifth generation of cellular technology. Its promises include greater speed, coverage, and responsiveness of wireless networks. How fast is it? Some network speeds show 1 gigabit per second. We're talking 10 to 100 times faster than a typical cellular connection. Think being able to download an entire season of a Netflix series in mere seconds. It's also about low latency. Latency is the response time between clicking a link or starting a video stream on a mobile phone and the time it takes the network to receive the request and open the link or begin playing the video. That lag time can last around 20 milliseconds with current networks, according to CNET, but with 5G, that time gets reduced to as quick as 1 millisecond. That opens up the possibility of remote surgeries and self-driving cars that can communicate with each other in real time, and even the possibility of heavy machinery that's operated by remote control. What makes it work? According to CNET, 5G initially used super high frequency spectrum, which has a shorter range but higher capacity, to deliver a bigger pipe for online access. But that super highway frequency spectrum has range and interference issues, so carriers are also using a lower frequency spectrum, those used in today's networks, to help get 5G across greater distances and through walls and other obstructions. When will it become a reality across the board? Some areas already have access to 5G. The only thing needed is a 5G smartphone, according to Digital Trends, even though all of the major U.S. carriers are rushing to build out 5G networks, deployment across the country will take several years. So far, only a few dozen cities have been identified as either having 5G connectivity or are being targeted for it. And a final note, Raleigh pops up only once on the latest list from Digital Trends in the following category: cities with AT&T 5G for businesses. Charlotte makes an appearance twice, cities with AT&T 5G for businesses, and cities to get Verizon 5G. This next story is written by Caleb Harshberger. Durham Tech Company expands campus near RTP. Cree Incorporated is expanding its footprint east of the Research Triangle Park with a recent purchase of a 7-acre property abutting its existing campus. The Durham company made the $8 million purchase, including an office building, this month. The property is situated at 4407 Silicon Drive and hosts a four-story, 81,000-square-foot office building. The land abuts Cree's existing campus on two sides. The seller, Austin, Texas-based Oak Point, bought the property for $2 million last April, according to county records. The county values the property at $2.95 million. Cree has said it plans to invest $500 million in its Durham site to expand its materials production. Cree is a semiconductor company focused on silicon carbide and GaN, or G-A-N, gallium nitride technologies, and its business is growing. In November alone, Cree announced multiple new partnerships and initiatives, including one with ZF Friedrichshafen AG, which will create electrical drive lines for next-generation vehicles and boost the Durham firm's semiconductor business, known as Wolfspeed. And finally, in the Triangle Business Journal, we look at the Business Survey Pulse. The question, do you want to see more e-scooters in Raleigh? 203 was the number of responses. No, 54%. Yes, 46%. And we'll go ahead and stop there, as we have run out of time for today's episode of the Triangle Business Journal. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Today's program is generously underwritten by Brian Lee Funeral Homes, located in Raleigh, Garner, and Anger. They can be reached at 919-832-8225. They believe every life is unique and deserves to be honored, so that every funeral is as unique and special as the person it represents. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.